Hello, and welcome to the Deeply Happy Expert Series. This is your host, Dr. Tarai, and this is the place where we explore with you how to heal depression, conquer fear, and finally fulfill your potential. And I want to thank you for joining us in this exclusive conversation we're having via your Happiness Lab Pass. And we're talking about a really, really important topic that I know a lot of you have struggled with. So we are going to talk about tools for co-managing anxiety with Michael Gelbart. So Michael Gelbart is an integrative psychotherapist. He's a soul guide. He's an intimacy and relationship coach, and he's been in practice for over 30 years. He specializes in addiction recovery, emotional self-regulation, trauma resolution, conflict mediation, holistic wellness, and conscious communication for couples. Michael, thanks so much for joining us at Deeply Happy.
Thank you so much, Tarai. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know that you wanted to start with a grounding exercise, and so I'm going to give you the floor just so you can start to do that.
Thank you. Well, a good way to begin in getting beneath or undoing anxiety is to really come inward into our deeper self and in our connection with the ground. It's like a lightning rod that we need to be able to ground energy. Anxiety is basically energy that doesn't quite have its anchor. So anchoring ourselves in our bodies, especially in our feet and our legs and our connection to the ground, is a very useful practice. So let's begin with inviting anyone who's listening to just take a moment to relax your eyes, soften your eyes, and soften your attention inward. Just notice your breath as you come in and down towards your feet and your legs and anything that is now in contact, any parts of you that are now in contact with the ground or the chair that you're sitting in. So taking a moment to come into contact with the earth beneath you, feeling your feet, feeling any sensations in your legs that you might notice, temperature, texture, any kind of pressure that's happening inside of your legs, in your hips. Feeling your sits bone on the chair, on the couch, wherever you are, and really landing inside of your actual physical embodiment. Feeling into your pelvis and all the bones and the muscles in your hips and your pelvic structure. Feeling into your structure. And letting gravity pull you down, letting yourself surrender to the gravity. Feeling into your spine, and sensing your spine and any contact your spine has with a chair or couch that you're sitting on, and relaxing backwards. Sitting back, resting. Feeling the flexibility and the strength in your spine. There's a poet, Hafez, who says, "The universe has been germinating in your spine for a long time. There's so much intelligence in our spines." And now feeling within the pelvic bowl, all the internal visceral organs, our life force, our life energy, sensing all that life energy within. Sensing the diaphragm, the breathing muscles beneath the rib cage, and sensing into the upper torso, the heart, the lungs, letting the breath just come and go like waves in the ocean. Letting our shoulders be heavy, relaxed, dropping towards the earth, while there's a gentle uplift coming up the spine, lifting up like a golden thread to the sky, so that there's both simultaneously an upward movement and a downward movement in our spines and in our bodies. Letting the neck be relaxed, kind of lightly moving, just subtle micro movements in the neck to relax the neck. The neck is a common place that we hold tension and stress. Just tucking the chin a bit, sensing moving our heads towards our heart just for a moment, and letting our heads move freely above our shoulders. Very subtly, relaxing behind our eyes, between our ears, relaxing our facial muscles, even have a little bit of a stretch, and if you like to take your hands and just use your hands as tools to just be soothing your body. You can hold your chest or hold your belly, and squeeze your shoulders. Give a little bit of massage to your neck. Rub your temples for a moment. Rub behind your eyes. Just gently massaging your face. Ah. And a deep exhale breath. And then just being here, being present, and Tarai and I will have a conversation about anxiety and what sources of anxiety there are and how to undo anxiety in our systems. Yeah?
Thank you. That definitely helped me calm down. It's easy to forget that coming into our own being and settling into our own energy, and even just the self-touch, can be so healing and soothing. And it's something that we all have access to all day long. And it still is such a potent example of how we can regulate our emotions, how we can shift our state with just a little bit of attention. You know, I'll admit that in the first couple of seconds where you were guiding the exercise, I felt myself get really antsy. And those of you who are listening might be able to relate with this. You know, you get a little bit antsy, like, oh, there's all this stuff I have to do. I don't have time to relax. So it's nice to give some time and space for the body and the mind and the spirit to just settle. So thank you for that exercise, Michael.
Welcome. Yeah, the anxiety has a tendency to take us up and out.
Mm-hmm.
And so even the phrase calming down, right, just suggests a kind of down and in. And when working with any kind of intense emotion, it's always good to have sort of one soft eye looking in and the other one looking out. So we're always, the awareness or the attention practice is so key to recognizing when something is stirring inside of our system. So we get these sensations or indicators, signals of distress in our system. So the antsiness, for example. Oh, there's antsiness there. Like, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
What's the antsiness want? Well, yeah, so there's a whole inquiry there based on, huh, What's that agitation? What's that antsiness? What's activated in my nervous system? What's the signal? And that requires a coming into and recognizing and an inquiring into. What is that signal in my system there?
It's and so like, what is that? Go ahead.
It's kind of like a pause.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that it's really important to have that pause so that we can actually check in with what actually is there. Because like you said, a lot of us can spend time being up and out, sort of outside of our body, or maybe up in our heads, or and you know, thinking about a million things almost simultaneously, but really jumping from one thought to the other. And the exercise you just shared with us, and also the idea that you're offering here, is that when we do take that time, when you do take that time to allow your body some time and space to settle, then it gives some space for you to inquire into, oh, so there is some agitation there, whereas you might not have realized it beforehand. So awareness is, you know, awareness is the first step, and creating the space for awareness is the pre-step to that.
Exactly. It's kind of like digesting after a meal.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take some time to metabolize what we've already experienced.
Huh, that's a really good way of putting it. So after, for example, after you had a long day, or after you've had a really interesting experience, or an interesting trip somewhere, or however you want to schedule that pause, you know, to create pause, or, you know, Brené Brown calls it white space, you know, creating a pause or white space where you can just be and take it in and digest. And that's such a good way of putting it. And it also points out that a lot of us don't spend time to digest even our food. So that's I think the first piece that I want you guys to take from this. It's so simple and it's so primal, but just taking that space.
One of the practices that I give to people is an end of the day practice. So people that are very busy and accomplishment oriented, and they're very focused and, you know, working a lot to get things done all day long, and even that night they may lay down and not be able to unwind. You know, a few people like that just can't unwind, right? They're so wound up and always on, and even at night when they put their head on the pillow, they're thinking about what they're doing the next day. And it's kind of overdoing. It's kind of always doing a constant sympathetic arousal in the nervous system,
right,
and activation. And so for people that are like that, that are overactivated and kind of constantly on, may have a hard time sleeping or falling asleep, may have a hard time unwinding. One of the practices I suggest is at night before going to bed, a kind of a counting of the soul. It's actually an ancient Hebrew practice that's looking at the day that you've already experienced and digesting the day, going through reviewing the day. And maybe it's in relation to a particular kind of intention you've set for the day. Let's say you're working on cultivating patience. It's a good one. So at the end of the day, you might look at, how was I patient? Where was I patient? Where was I not patient today? And so instead of planning the next day, like letting the next day, trusting the next day to take care of itself to some degree, you may have your list, you have your goals, but tucking the day away and letting the day that's been really be digested and metabolized inside of us, so we can really feel our sense of accomplishments, really feel a gratification or a satisfaction or fulfillment with what we've done, not always just focusing on what we have to do next.
Yeah, a lot of people, for example, will make a list. Well, at least I do this, and you listening might do this as well. You know, make a list at the end of the day of what I need to do next tomorrow. Like, what's on tap? You know, what am I going to add? What other boxes do I want to check by tomorrow? And it's such a valuable practice before that point or after? I don't know what you recommend, Michael.
Probably after. I say, look, take your time, have your dinner, enjoy your evening, and about an hour and a half before you go to bed, write your list. Know what you want to do the next day, and then turn off your work mode.
Yeah.
Enjoy. Have a sleep hygiene. Have a restfulness that is intentional to disengage that active part and allow the rest. It's so crucial for the nervous system. So write your list by all means, and then put it there on your desk. And like I like to say, the bed is for pleasure and relaxation and rest, not for work. Someone is worrying in bed or thinking about the next day in bed, I suggest you get up, go to your office, go somewhere else, and have your bed be for pleasure and relaxation and rest.
Yeah, that's a really important piece, to just create this space where only restfulness happens. So if you're worried about something, or there's a bunch of things you remembered that you had to do tomorrow, just get up, add it to your list, go to your desk, add it to your list, and then begin again in the process of releasing and digesting the day.
Exactly.
So that's such a really great practice, and I'm gonna start doing that. I don't do that as consistently as I'd like, and I like the way you talk about it. It's funny because, I talk about sleep hygiene a lot with my patients, when we work on anxiety. And, we do turn off all your electronic devices and, dim the lights and maybe even put some relaxing music if that helps for you. But I haven't added the portion which says sit quietly and do an accounting of the soul. So thank you for adding that piece, that soulfulness piece. It's not just our biochemistry that needs to wind down. It's the soul. So,
exactly.
And that's perfect, because, what we're talking about now is anxiety, and the ways in which we co-manage anxiety. And of course, anxiety, as you mentioned, is a state where it's tempting to think about it, at least for me, as a biochemical thing that's happening. And it's important to remember that it's happening on so many levels, that sort of sense of alertness and arousal. And it also happens not just within ourselves, but in relation or in connection to our interactions with other people. And I think that's close to the heart of what you really teach, Michael, is that, managing or adjusting or shifting our state is one thing, but co-managing it or co-regulating it is another piece. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about what you mean when you say co-managing anxiety or co-regulating. What does that actually mean, and what does it entail?
Well, on some level, we're all touched by insecurity in this world, in this life. And it may be that some of us, some fortunate ones of us, have had very secure parenting and very secure attachments. And so by that I mean there's been a safety and a sanctuary and a calmness in our nervous system that's been cultivated from a young age in our familial environment. And the percentages of secure attachment versus insecure attachment, something like 20% secure attachment. I don't know the current figures. And so many of us are experiencing some degree of insecurity. And if it's not, sometimes we might think, well, it's not mine, it's this other person's insecurity. We just have different styles of managing that. And there's a whole realm of research now that's focused on the neurobiology of attachment, security, attachment insecurity. So Sue Johnson's emotion-focused therapy is a really good way to move into that direction if someone is interested. Check out her book, Hold Me Tight, is a really good book for couples navigating insecurity. So what happens in, let's say, for example, with couples is insecurity, anxiety, distress emotions come into the system, and they're in the system, whether it's anger, whether it's shame and withdrawal factors that occur, whether it's acute anxiety and tension, these uncomfortable affects come into the system, and it's not just a matter then of one person regulating the emotions or each person regulating their own emotions. To some degree, it's done as a team. And
so when you say, I'm just going to interrupt because I wanted to clarify, when you say it comes into the system, you mean that it comes into the system that is the couple. Is that what you're saying?
When you right, say the system. Right. So the guy doesn't do dishes, and then he says, I shouldn't do dishes. Well, the wife is then triggered, and what do you mean? So right there, I mean, fights occur. Distress occurs or anxiety occurs as triggers in the system. It gets activated. And it can get activated in a moment. I'm going to snap my fingers. You know, just like in a moment, suddenly a couple is in some kind of distress. And so that distress needs to be navigated. Right? And so how that gets navigated is typically patterned in. There are patterns of managing anxiety and trying to do that ourselves. Someone, for example, may really shut down when they get anxious, right? And say one person in the couple shuts down and closes off and contracts and withdraws away. Well, that activates the other person who has feelings of abandonment when their spouse has just shut down and gone into their cave.
Mm-hmm.
And their response is perhaps to get more anxious and more vocal and more verbal, which shuts the other person down even further.
Right? Are you saying, Michael, that because you're describing sort of a very typical pattern between couples, right, where there's some tension. It might start with one person or they might both be feeling it. One person, responds to it by shutting down. It triggers the other person's own insecurities around being abandoned or being left. And it might cause them to sort of escalate their own bids for attention, for example. So you're describing something that I think a lot of us can really relate to. And I'm wondering, is what you're saying that what seems to be a lot of what we perceive as, you know, fights or arguments, it almost sounds like what you're saying is that this has a root in anxiety. Like there's that as a couple, for example, because we're talking about couples and intimacy and co-management, that there can be an underlying anxiety that we don't even realize is anxiety. Is that accurate?
Exactly. I'd say, insecurity, basically. It's a lack of safety.
Yeah.
It's a threat or a sense of danger or a sense of something's wrong here, and that's activated within the system. So that the most intimate other sometimes can feel like they're against me or they're not with me. It's very primal.
Okay.
It's very primal. One thing I like to say that the limbic brain, the emotional brain, is an open system. It's not like the circulatory system in our bodies. It's an open system. So we feel empathy for others, right, mm-hmm. which is one of the key tools in all of this, compassion, empathy, openness, feeling what someone else is feeling, being in tune with what someone else is feeling. Those are the keys to working through the anxiety. What happens with this open system, however, is that emotions are contagious. So we can get triggered if someone is angry, we feel it. If someone is anxious in the room, we feel it.
Right, as opposed to a closed system, like you said, like the blood system, the circulatory system. You know, my blood is pretty much my blood, and it's not going to really mingle with anyone else's for the most part. But
right.
When we talk about the way our emotional, our emotional brain or our limbic system works, it's influenced by everyone around us. I mean, that's part of what makes us sort of a living, breathing human being, is that we are influenced by the emotions of others, and they can be really subtle. Whether or not the person intends to share them, right? Like, you have to choose to donate your blood to me, but you're sharing your emotions with me whether you intend to or not, and I'm picking up on that.
Right, and if I'm secure enough, or I can hold that security in the system, then the system can become secure. Sometimes the system can get overwhelmed by insecurity. You know, if there's really intense, really strong a fear response, or if someone, especially where there's trauma in a system, right? When someone's been traumatized and has a lot of anxiety in their system that's unresolved trauma, that trauma can get re-triggered and reactivated. And so people are acting from a place of greater intensity in a situation that doesn't necessarily seem like couples will often say, well, we're fighting about the smallest stuff. It's not about the small stuff that we're fighting about. It's about what happens in the triggering process and that anxiety that gets stirred and how well that anxiety gets co-regulated, right? Mm-hmm. So the difference, again, between self-regulation of anxiety, which is I'm going to take care of myself and calm myself, go into my cave, take my walk, do my hike, have a swim, all those great things, have good nutrition, all those great things that help us regulate our own anxiety internally, give us strength to be able to be within a system and keep our sense of security stable and constant. Whereas if we're shakier or we've had some trauma or we've had some upheaval or we're in some kind of transition, there's a myriad ways that couples or individuals can get off their stability and need support, need an anchoring from someone else, like a child needs security from a mother, right? We need that holding environment. We need that secure holding environment. And in a sense, as a therapist, what I'm doing as a therapist is continually recreating a secure holding environment so people can have corrective emotional experiences of feeling safe within a relationship. The safety within the relationship is a real core need that we have. So it isn't just, we're not just islands. It isn't just about self-regulating our affect and being independent. We also have needs sometimes to be held or to be listen to or to have connection or for meaning. We have needs that aren't just those that we meet for ourselves.
Okay, so I want to really dive into that because it's very compelling. You know, what you're saying is that, you know, it's one thing to manage your own emotions. It's another thing, and it's another more delicate art, it seems like, to actually co-manage, you know, understand that when there is a, you know, there, let's just call it anxiety, when there's anxiety and it's happening between more than one person, and that can look like insecurity or maybe even anger, there's a way to manage it as a pair. And so what are some ways that we can do that?
Well, that's a great question, and it helps when you have someone who has a willingness to practice with you. So, for example, if it's a high conflict couple, they're going to tend to get more conflictual. If they can agree to a kind of a stop and time out rule, that helps. So having a conscious agreement around an intention or purpose to be a team, to be a cooperative team, together we're going to create security inside of our system. It's almost like a contract that trumps everything else. If one of us feels insecure, then both of us have some insecurity, and both of us need to rise to the occasion to create more stability in the system. So that's one way to look at it, is really having an agreement between you and your spouse or you and your friend. Hey, I'm feeling some insecurity and I need some stability. Can you help me?
And then that's so it starts with asking for it, with acknowledging the vulnerability and then asking for something from the other person.
And that's easier said than done.
Exactly.
If you're able to acknowledge your vulnerability and ask for help, you've already done two-thirds of your personal growth work.
Right.
There's so many people that have a hard time asking for what they want. They think the other person should already know, should be reading their minds. So that is a key part here, is being able to say, is being able to acknowledge feeling vulnerable. And that can differ for men and women. It can be harder for some men to acknowledge vulnerability. Men can feel a responsibility to be the provider of that stability and security. And so if men are feeling insecure, they can struggle to some degree double with acknowledging that insecurity they may be feeling and asking for something that they want or need.
What do you see really helps men who come to that place of being able to talk about their vulnerability or acknowledge their vulnerability? What are some ways that, you know, for men, it seems like there's a strong societal pressure to not be vulnerable, more so than women, or maybe just a different kind of vulnerability. But what do you see is a way for men to start that process of being able to first acknowledge, even recognize, and then acknowledge, and then express?
Right. Well, I just came off of a week at Burning Man where I taught a couple of courses for men called Maturing the Masculine, and had some really wonderful participation and great insights that came from that. And one of the insights is that men need to know, in my opinion, when to turn to other men for support and when to turn to women. There are times in which the medicine that men need is actually from other men.
Mm.
And so if men have that kind of support with each other, it makes a huge difference. It's made a huge difference in my life. I have men I can call on and talk to and tell them I'm feeling lousy, and it makes a huge difference to feel supported by another man or by other men. So men's work, I really recommend for men that have never explored that to consider exploring being in a men's group for a period of time and seeing how that benefits. Then we don't look to our women for everything. And men can sometimes look to women too much for nurturance or for comfort and soothing, and sometimes can turn women into their mothers and sort of require this kind of nurturing that can mess with the polarity in the relationship and the sexuality in the relationship. So it's a kind of balancing act where men need to have the support and strength of other men so they're not in isolation and they realize that these are shared emotions that other men feel that really can heal the shame that men can feel around feeling needy, quote-unquote, or feeling vulnerable, or feeling like they're not providing as strongly as they'd like to be. So,
and what can women do to support their men in that process? Because I know we have a lot of people tuning into this that are women. We have men and women. So I kind of want to look at it from all angles, right? So I love your idea of men having men's groups that, you know, they can use. You know, it's interesting because, you know, as a woman, I think about it in the same way of like, oh, I need to have a strong women's, you know, I need to have some good girlfriends around me in my life so that I don't lean on my husband too much. And it's such an interesting perspective for you to say, yeah, men need that too. I mean, it seems really obvious. And what you're saying is sometimes that doesn't happen. And
right.
in a male-female relationship, the man can start to over-rely on the woman for emotional support. And you're right, it does set up this sort of mothering relationship, which is not sexy and, you know, can kind of put out a lot of the fires that attracted them to each other in the first place. So,
right.
So go ahead.
Yep.
So for a woman, for example, how can I support, for example, the cultivation of vulnerability or this whole process in a man?
Right. Well, I'd say the same thing. First of all, that women can turn men into their fathers to some degree as well. There can be a kind of there can be this immense father hunger in our culture. And both men and women can feel that. Again, if there's been a really stable father figure, then we're fortunate. You know, one that we could go to that has emotional intelligence and social intelligence and would actually hold us and take us through our emotions and help us to develop, that is a very fortunate person that has had that kind of fathering, and or very strong male role models of security and safety and guidance. And so having those kinds of male teachers or male guides can be very useful for women and for men in different ways. So it takes some pressure off of the primary relationship. We can load up our primary relationships with too much needs and expectations and demands and expect so much that used to be the village took care of a lot more.
Mm.
So we do need the village. You know, we do need a wider support system. Men and women need a wider support system. And so guys really need to feel valued. That's, of course, true for women as well. It's just that the appreciation and acknowledgement of what we have done or what we do accomplish, men are very built in to be providers. And so that acknowledgement of what the contributions are, how much the contributions are appreciated, that's really a healing balm for men that I see. It's really feeling valued and appreciated for what we do. And if men, let's say women have, in some marriages, women are the ones that are working, men are maybe at home, so there's reversals of roles as well. So there's you know, bottom line is really a communications terai, isn't it? That an ability to kind of own what our own experience is and take a lot of ownership of what our needs are and to be able to communicate from a place of respect to the other person and really tune into what their experience is and being mindful of what it is that we're projecting onto the other person. There's a school of communications, nonviolent communications, NVC, that I want to just put a shout out for that I would recommend people check into. It's a very simple communications method that really emphasizes respectful communications. What are my needs? What are your needs? What am I asking for? What are you asking for? Needs and requests versus demands. And it's a very simple system of communications that breaks down communications into its elemental parts. And
can you give an example? I'm a big fan of nonviolent communication as well, and I know that a lot of folks might not have heard about it yet. So what's a basic breakdown of how to express a need or to communicate in a way that's nonviolent, let's say between couples? What's an example of how to do that?
Well, one of the best distinctions I've learned recently from that school is the difference between evaluations and feelings. So I might say, well, I feel abandoned or I feel betrayed. And those, in a sense, are, you know, we take those as if they're feelings. And what they are more is they're more cognitive than that. They're more evaluative than that. We're actually making a perceptual decision that says, oh, this is betrayal. And it's different than saying, wow, I feel really hurt. I feel really scared. I feel ashamed, angry. Those are basic emotions.
So it's not enough to say, I feel. It's not really, if you say, I feel abandoned, it's not really, you're not really getting to the heart of it, you know, the true emotion of it. I, the way I like to think about it is, is that what a five-year-old would say?
Yeah,
you know,
like
bringing it down to that, like, basic primal emotional true feeling.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying, right?
Right, yeah, people can oftentimes use I feel and then say the most unbelievable things that are arguable, and that's also my distinction. If it's arguable, it isn't a feeling.
Ah.
I feel rejected. Well, I'm not rejecting you. That doesn't take us anywhere. You know,
right.
I feel like you're an, like the classic example I like, I feel like you're an asshole. That's not quite a feeling.
Not really a feeling. You're right, but you know, because we, you know, a lot of us have done a little. Go ahead.
Right. I'm just telling you what I'm feeling. No, yeah. That's not exactly a feeling.
Right. So I guess it starts with just literacy in terms of, you know, emotional literacy, knowing exactly, you know, what is a feeling and learning how to identify that feeling. And part of that is the process of vulnerability, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's easier for me to say, well, I feel like you're, you know, being a jerk right now, because it doesn't require me to reveal anything about my actual hurt. Versus if I say, well, I feel really hurt that you did that, or that made me really sad. It's a totally different vibration than saying, I think you're a jerk. You know, when I say that, for example, I feel that kind of up in my head, and it makes sense because it's a judgment and it has a kind of hard feeling. Versus when I say, you know, I feel really sad and I feel that in my belly.
Right.
And, you know, it feels embodied and it feels really tender. Like I feel my belly kind of get a little, you know, clench a little, but also get a little bit soft. And I think that's a distinction when we start to talk about, you know, talking about your feelings and framing things in I feel statements, making sure to check in.
Exactly. It requires us to check in and soften and slow down and pause. Like, it's not about action in that moment. It's about reflection. It's about, what's curiously? What am I actually experiencing right now in this moment?
What's going on in my system?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of what I was bringing this to is, so, you know, bringing it back to anxiety, right? So, you know, I experience anxiety, for example, and I especially have, this is just an example, but, you know, and let's say I have more anxiety when I'm around certain people, like certain family members, for example, or my intimate partner. How does that apply? You know, if someone is experiencing anxiety, there's already fear, right? And if there's already fear, how can one then drop into a state where they actually make themselves vulnerable? I can just imagine, you know, some of you who are listening saying, I'm already afraid. You know, I already feel anxious. I don't want to feel more vulnerable. What then? What can someone do in that case?
That's a really, really good question. In some situations, we're not going to want to, it's not safe to be vulnerable with somebody. So we're not going to express to them our vulnerability. Now, unfortunately, people can see it. You know, people can recognize when we're distressed or anxious or vulnerable. You know, there are signals that people can read. We can tell each other's emotions, so it's kind of hard to hide. Now we're not safe in a certain situation with someone. We're going to want to get away with it from that person. You know, there's the typical fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, right? The four Fs. So when we're in a kind of distressed situation, then we're sizing up the situation. Can I get away and run away right now? How can I get out of the room? A lot of people have flight patterns, right? And interestingly, I like to just, as an aside, acknowledge, you know, the psoas muscles. When I was taking us through the grounding exercise from the ground up, sensing into the pelvis and into the groin, into the psoas muscles, the postural muscles, it's a really important aspect of sensing into our nervous system. And I've heard the psoas called the flight muscles.
So explain the psoas, just for our listeners who aren't anatomy savvy.
The psoas, P-S-O-A-S, those are the muscles that the biggest muscle in the body. It's the postural muscles that wraps around the pelvis and connects with the diaphragm in the front, it connects with the sacrum in the back, and wraps around the pelvis and basically enables us to stand and move and run and bicycle ride and play tennis. Really important muscles to get to know. And so calling those muscles the flight muscles is saying that when we're in a kind of flight situation, we're in a danger situation, we feel we're with someone that's unsafe, we want to get away, those muscles are going to contract.
Hmm.
And so a lot of low back pain really can be attributed to chronic contraction of the flight muscles.
So,
right?
so different than the fight muscles,
they're more like the shoulders. I think of the shoulders more as the fight muscles. Can I push this person? Can I make boundaries here? Can I make my space? That isn't about, hey, I'm going to tell you how vulnerable I feel. That's about protection and safety. And so I'm going to take care of my own safety. If I don't feel safe with someone, it's going to be hard for me to tell that person, hey, I really feel unsafe with you, unless the situation itself provides some safety. Maybe there are some others there. There's someone that can witness, like a therapist or a mediator. If that person is even willing to have a conversation, and if it's a worthwhile conversation, we have to make a choice about whom we're going to be vulnerable with. It's not an obligation. It's a practice.
That's a really, really good point. Yeah, it's not an obligation. It's actually a privilege to witness someone else's vulnerability. And so, you know, we talk about vulnerability, and some people are not the right people to share that vulnerability with if they have historically not been supportive of other times you've been vulnerable. So that's I think that's a really good point to make.
Yeah, and we're not reading each other. I mean, our eyes, we're reading each other. We walk into a room and we're noticing who feels safe, who feels resonant, who doesn't, who feels dangerous, who feels exciting. We're picking that information up semi-consciously all the time when we're in an interpersonal situation. So, like, for example, a lot of people come to me with social anxiety. It's really a malady, right? If we had a classroom of 100 people raised and measured how many of those 100 people in the classroom have some degree of social anxiety, I would bet there would be a good 20, 30, maybe more. It's not something people go out and announce. Hey, I'm anxious, you know. People are defending and hiding and protecting and masking their emotions, or attempting to do so all the time. That's what makes it complex, is we are attempting to decipher signals in our own bodies, right, our own affect systems, and in other people's affect systems.
So and I want to make sure that we get a way to, we're kind of starting to wrap up, and I want to make sure that we get to this piece here, because I think that's where you're going, is, so, you know, we do have a lot of people with social anxiety. So when that comes up, you know, when anxiety arises, and you're in a group situation, what do you do? What are some things that someone can do to help to manage that anxiety, to help to calm down the nervous system if they have that kind of problem, that kind of experience?
Sure. So I'd like to offer some keys to undoing social anxiety. So one key is to recognize physical sensations. And the way I focus the meditation on the feet and the legs is a good place to focus beneath the nervous system and connecting to the feet and the legs and really sensing that. You know, public speakers are suggested to them that they hold their hands on their hips. So that's a way of connecting with the legs and the feet, paying attention to posture, bending your knees slightly if you're standing, taking a step back if you're in a situation, a slight step back, noticing what the tension patterns are in the body and contracting those tensions paradoxically. So if you notice that you're holding tension in your arms and you squeeze your arms even more for like 3 or 4 seconds, like what is done in progressive muscle relaxation, you can squeeze the muscles for 3 or 4 seconds and then take a deep breath and relax the arms more fully. So that's one key, is recognizing the physical sensations, and slight movements is another key. Just slight movements, shifting your body position, like I said, bending your knees a little bit, moving to a different place in the room, shifting posture makes a huge difference. So I call my work Shift in Perspective. It's like we can just shift the perspective somewhat. We get a different angle on the situation, altering the positioning of your feet or your shoulders or your hips, unfreezes and mobilizes. So if freezing is the way you're experiencing the distress, unfreezing can be done in very small microcosmic ways that are not even barely perceptible to others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's, I want to, one of the tips that you mentioned is interesting to me because it's a little counterintuitive. So I wonder if we could do a little quick exercise that is around the noticing the muscles that are contracted and then contracting them and then release them. Can you lead us through a quick exercise of doing that? I think that's something that would be kind of fun to do and simple enough to do.
Sure. So I would recommend first a body scan. So for everyone who's listening, just take a moment to really scan through your body from head to toes. Just scan. And notice any kind of tension patterns that you may be holding anywhere in your body. Just scanning through all the different systems in your body. Scanning your muscles. Scanning different areas of your body, shoulders, torso. And as you scan and you notice any kind of tension that you might be holding, squeeze that area consciously and intentionally. 3 or 4 seconds, and then release.
So if I feel there's tension or contraction in my shoulders, I'll just like pull the shoulder
tighter. Squeeze, right. Squeeze it tighter like you're hugging yourself. Like give yourself a big hug, really squeeze 3, 4, 5 seconds.
Okay.
And then release it. And now bring the breath into that even more. So I want to suggest a particular kind of breathing practice, a conscious breathing practice. So I invite you to take a long, slow inhale and hold it at the top of the inhalation for 4 or 5 seconds. Long, slow inhale. Hold it at the top. Sip more breath in. Sip more breath in. Sip more breath in. Hold it. And then long, slow exhale through the nose or through the mouth, but controlling that exhale, releasing like you're blowing into a balloon. And then pause at the bottom of the exhale, letting all the air out until the next long inhale naturally rises up. And repeating that 4 times. So again, a long, slow inhale, sipping in, bringing as much oxygen into your lungs as possible and as deeply as possible, holding it at the top for 4 seconds, and then long, slow exhale. You can make a sound. Some people will chant. Some people will use their exhale through their nose to lengthen that exhale. The bottom, letting all the air out until the next long inhale naturally rises, and ride the wave of that inhale. Lengthening the breath. Letting sound out is often a good way to release. Whether it's laughter, or it's a yawn, or it's a tone, or it's a primal yell, whatever releases that charge, helps to relax and kick in the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, it's interesting when the breath holding and releasing. I definitely feel a lot more. Again, there's a sense of relaxation. So thank you for sharing that. Michael.
I'd offer one last piece that I'd like to offer.
Okay, go.
So it's that one more key to working with anxiety is anxiety is a signal. Distress is really, I'd say more generally, I like to actually reference, you know, there's distress in the system. Anxiety is one kind of distress. Shame, anger, those are different kinds of distresses. But they're all signals, and they're all indicators from the subconscious, from our soul. They're signals from our souls that want to be interpreted and deciphered. And so I encourage and invite everyone to have a friendliness, an openness, and a curiosity towards whatever our experience is. It can just be uncertainty. So much of anxiety is uncertainty. It's not knowing. Right? So being friendly towards that, being open, being curious, and inquiring into, I was like, huh, what is this tension going on in my shoulder here? Huh, what is this? And being that curious also with our partners that are going through something. If we can have that attitude of curiosity towards each other, and openness and non-judgment of just being friendly with, we're experiencing something here. What is this? I think that's such a beautiful approach to honoring our emotional bodies, right? Honoring the gifts of our emotions, like the keyboard of life. It's the keyboard of emotions, right? So just learning how to play the keys, learning how to make music. Emotions are what motivate us. Emotions are what gives us passion and zeal and drive. So honoring our emotions, being friendly with ourselves and each other, and being kind with ourselves is a really good way to go.
Thanks for sharing that piece. I think that's really important, you know, versus trying to just run away from an unpleasant emotion or making it go away, to be curious about it and be friendly towards it and not consider it the enemy.
Right, not just managing and coping, but actually learning and growing from these experiences that our souls unfold to us.
Michael, I know that you are you're offering a free intimacy coaching call to people who want to learn more from you. So can you share how we can learn more and how we can get in touch and find out about that free intimacy coaching call that you have lined up?
All right, please check out my website, Intimacy Perspectives, and there's a place there that you can sign up for the free coaching call. And if you're really interested in working with me, you can email me and we can set up something. We can have a bit of a conversation to see if we're a good match and if we want to do some work together. I do Skype or FaceTime sessions for people that are not local. And thank you very much, Tarai. You're an awesome healer and medicine person and now such a great coordinator of this conference. And thank you so much for including me in this summit.
You're so welcome. Thanks so much for being a part of this, Michael. And for those of you who do want to learn more about what Michael does and get an alert to when he does offer his free intimacy coaching conference call, just hop onto his website. It's www.shiftinperspective.com, and that link is also, it's not going to be on our listen page because this is a Happiness Lab Pass only call, so we'll make sure to have that for you via email. So that you can get in touch with Michael or you can sign up for his free intimacy coaching conference call, shiftinperspective.com. Michael, thank you so much.
Shiftinperspective.com or intimacyperspectives.com, they both bring you to the same place.
Okay, great. Shiftinperspective.com or intimacyperspectives.com. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and sharing your heart and sharing your experience with us. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Tarai. I appreciate you very much. Aloha.
Aloha, and thank you for listening in. I hope this was helpful for you. If you learned something that really moved you, feel free to share it on the Facebook group or shoot me an email. Let me know how you liked it. So until our next call, be well, be kind to yourself, and may you be deeply happy.
Yes.